Hello and welcome to the Real Maxime Podcast. I'm Maxime, your host. I'm an economist, former tech entrepreneur, hedge fund founder, and private investor. Credit scores have been around since 1989. They are also known as FICO scores, which the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau describes as a pioneering methodology for calculating credit scores based on information collected by credit reporting agencies. Many financial institutions have long touted the FICO score as an equitable way to determine a person's creditworthiness. But there's a problem with this model. It seems to reward the people who are already doing okay financially and penalize those who are not. And the rejection of the latter's application for home or auto or other types of loans can arguably perpetuate a vicious cycle of not being able to break out of poverty or other conditions. In sum, building credit can be tricky. But over the past few years, a few companies have emerged as proponents of financial inclusion and credit accessibility. My guest today, Michael Broughton, is a founder of Altro, a credit building platform that uses recurring monthly expenses, including rent and subscriptions like Netflix or Spotify, to build one's credit. While attending USC, Michael was denied a $10,000 loan needed to cover the remainder of his tuition due to family finances and a lack of credit history. This frustrating catch-22 inspired Michael to create a business focused on financial inclusion. Altro finds a person's recurring transactions and connects them to a trade line, a line of data that goes directly into a bureau system that affects a person's FICO score, which is then used for underwriting. That is then reported to all three credit bureaus. After attending pitch competition after pitch competition, the team was able to land a $250,000 investment from Jay-Z's Marcy Ventures, prompting Michael to drop out of school to focus full-time on Altro. Soon after, their app went viral, with over 200,000 downloads and shooting up to the top 10 in an app store. Altro was a Y Combinator class of 2020 and subsequently raised $18 million in a Series A funding round, led by Pendulum, with participation from Marcy Ventures, as well as City Ventures, Black Capital Fund, Concrete Rose Fund, and individual investors such as Dick Parsons and Deborah Quazzo. In this insightful conversation, we discuss Michael's upbringing in Korea and Japan in a military household, the importance of personal storytelling in pitching investors, the power of mentors and human capital scaling, and how to separate hype from execution in a new era of scarce capital. Michael is a Thiel Fellow, currently sits as vice chairman of the USC Credit Union, focused on empowering students to gain access to financial tools, and spends his free time with founders, providing insight to the world of venture capital and building a company as a proof of concept. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
I grew up overseas. I had the privilege of my family being military. So, you know, my dad was Air Force for 25 years. It gave me the ability to live in East Asia, actually, for most of my childhood. So from about 7 to, I would say, 16, 17, I was living in Okinawa, Japan, and Seoul, Korea, which is great. It gave me a very external perspective on not just the U.S. and our politics, but just way of life, culture, and presence. And it's definitely played into, I guess, my personality and who I've became as a person. So I grew up really meeting a lot of people, being adaptive, like kind of like a chameleon to my environment, and found a passion for speech and debate of all things when I was in high school, when I finally got back to the U.S. So a little sporadic. None of it has anything to do with fintech or entrepreneurship, but I think a level of being able to adapt to my environments and always explore new things without fear, I guess, really played into my personality.
You won't believe it, but in my seat, as I record those podcasts and meet extraordinary entrepreneurs and people, there are some patterns that emerge, especially when it comes to the entrepreneurial story. And you use the word chameleon, the moving around, adaptability, is actually one of those patterns. It's not the only explanatory factor, but it's one that comes up pretty often. And realistically, if you think about it, the ability to jump into a situation, read the room, understand, very quickly adapt and understand, blend in, maybe you have a few touch points with your audience and build a rapport, right? And it's helpful when you're trying to get to know people, convince them that you have a value proposition that is worth pursuing. So it's actually pretty common. Were all your studies in English? Did you learn foreign languages as you were abroad?
It's funny. When I was in Korea, I did learn basic Korean, learned early on Taekwondo. And when we moved to Japan, they quickly told me to drop Korean and pick up katakana, pick up kanji, which I got pretty good at until I came back to the U.S. And the first place we landed was South Dakota. And speaking any sort of foreign language in a place like South Dakota doesn't make any sense. So ended up losing it over time, unfortunately.
What kind of an impact did it have on you culturally, though? Do you find, like, I'm just curious, like, you find sometimes that you're craving certain foods and that, because these are very formative years. I don't know exactly what period of time you're abroad, but they're high impact years, right? And so I know this because I was an oil brat and lived in different countries, and there's certainly reminiscing about those days and those experiences. I'm curious as to what was the impression that it made on you.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I would say that I had to learn how to not have a home, right? Like, you build great rapport and friends, community for 3-4 years, and then the next day you're starting from scratch. And that was my routine, right? Like, I was okay with pivoting my lifestyle every 3-4 years, saying goodbye to friends and hello to new ones, which I didn't realize how unique that was when you are raised in the same area, or how drastic changing your high school, your sophomore year could be. But for me, it was very normal. And I would say that it had an impact on how I saw, like, politics. I didn't know about anything that was happening in the U.S., right? I did not know about police brutality issues. I did not realize that there was an issue with, I mean, there's a million and one things, but I just wasn't aware of it. So when I came back to the U.S., very quickly I learned that not everyone likes the police, that your skin color can affect you, right? The way you speak, the way you talk, where you're from are all factors that affect your way of life, which was not what I experienced when I lived in Japan or when I even lived in Korea. So it definitely changed my perspective. I think I had the privilege of not having a jaded view on the U.S., like, I wasn't raised into a community to have a certain perspective. And I think it allows me to look at situations a little bit differently than someone who may have grown up in the U.S. their entire life.
So in some ways, you sort of had that outwards or inwards looking view from the outside, almost, not exactly, almost like a foreigner or people who come to the country, right? So you're going to have a very, very different take on it. And that's why I think it's so fascinating. And it probably just gives you an ability to take a step back to your point and not necessarily get caught up in some of the dynamics that are very much almost become endogenous as you grew up in certain communities here, right, in the U.S. And you get wired in a certain way. And these are biases that are very hard to undo, right? And so not having been a part of it, hopefully you're able to take a step back and have a sound approach and view on the topic, but also see what's good and what's not so good. I'm curious as to, so you said you like debate. What were other, like, disciplines and topics that you liked as you, you know, started evolving and becoming a young adult? Like, what were the things that really got you going, both academically and socially, I'd say, and hobbies?
Yeah, I had to take my sport route. So I played football for a little bit, played basketball for a little bit. I was not good at either. I was just tall. But I would say academically, I wasn't really passionate about school. And I don't say that in the way that, you know, I didn't like to learn. I love learning. But I did find a lot of issues with the education system. A, the lack of competition or hidden competition, and we could talk about that more. It's a theory that I have in my head. But also B, the way that academics are presented, right? I think that learning is an art, and K through 12, you should be learning how to learn, or your best form of learning. And college and further should be applying your learning language, the way that you do learn, to a specific skill, trait, or vocational study. And I don't think that kids get the privilege of thinking that way when growing up in the American education system. But I did become very fascinated with, like, how do we teach? How do we learn? And how do I educate myself to be the best person I can be? So I was terrible with homework. I was terrible with, you know, organization. I'm a very disorganized person, but I mastered tests. That was my thing, was like, I taught myself how to take tests, and it wasn't knowing the information. It was knowing how to read and answer questions thoughtfully. So that led to me doing well on my ACT, my SAT, passing my classes, and put me in a unique position. I don't think that I know a lot of information. I think I just know how to understand and what my learning language is. And that's definitely applied to my company as well.
Talk to us a little bit about what you think in those years, because you started a business at an early age, right? And you decided to not complete your undergrad studies, right? If I recall correctly. So in those formative years, did you have an inkling that at some point you'd want to do something like that? Did you think that it was sort of in the back of your mind, or it's something that developed, you know, later?
It's funny. I don't know what this passion is, and maybe you could help me describe it, but there was two pivotal moments that made me realize I wanted to be an entrepreneur, and the latter is not as cool as the former. But the former was one of the classes I had to take was a class about stocks. And the goal was you had, you know, six classes all with 20 students holding their own stock, right? And the goal was to have the highest stock price by the end, like have the highest value that you could for your company. And it fascinated me. And it wasn't the class or the practice, or I was terrible at the actual class. I think I got a C in the class, but I ended first in the class in terms of my stock value. And I was just addicted to the fact that it was so free, right? Like, it didn't matter what you did or how you got there. It was self-taught or self-focused learning on how you can drive the price up. So I was calling people before and after classes. I was begging people to buy my stock and giving them agreements. Like, I would give people my lunch in exchange for them buying my stock. I got way too deep into it. But that was my first touch of what I would call entrepreneurship, and maybe not even entrepreneurship, but just business itself and the magic of it. And the second piece was I really wanted financial freedom for me and my family. And financial freedom, not meaning that I have loads of money, but whenever we went out to eat, there was nine of us in this household. You always had to look at the price. You always had to worry about what you're getting. We had to be so careful around money. And I think it limits creative freedom. I really wanted to get myself into a job or work or environment where I could kind of control my own destiny. And that slowly turned me into a business major, because I liked numbers, I liked creative freedom, and I wanted financial freedom, so I need to know numbers. And that's what led me down the business route. So I ended up going to college for poli sci, because I was a debate nerd, with a minor in business studies and business administration.
So that's interesting. Is there, I mean, if you unpack what you just said, right? There's several things there. One is there's an element of, you know, social validation, right? That you describe, right? And understanding the dynamics of social capital, right? And how it develops and how you build it, right? And on some level, that ties into trust. It's interesting, and not to go on a complete different tangent, because it is tied to what social capital really is, right? And the notion of trust that is so embedded implicitly in business, right? When people entrust you with an investment, they decide to vouch for you in the context of an introduction. I was on a call a few hours earlier, close friend of mine from business school introduces me to an LP. And if during the conversation, the LP really said, this is a call I would be taking outside of this triangulation. And I know I'm stating the obvious, but this notion of social capital is so prevalent. So understanding how to create that, how to build it, obviously at an early age, probably, and you say you weren't necessarily good at football or basketball, but probably, you know, building social capital is something that inherently, there's probably something there, right? That you could build a foundation on. And I like to think about what prepares one for this journey of entrepreneurship, that's definitely a good foundation to have. It's not a killer if you don't have it, but certainly you're going to have to work hard at developing it if it doesn't come to you naturally, right? So talk to us about college, and because it sounds like it was a very pivotal moment and a very important moment of your life, because many things were decided that led to what you're doing today. So I'd like to understand, because there is also a broader context and motivation as to why you started this business and why you're pursuing this path.
Yeah. And I feel like what you just tapped on really tells this story really well towards its end. But a lot of the story, I'm going to give you the unfiltered one, happened before college. You know, again, I came from what I would consider a low income family. The military doesn't pay the most money. And having 9 kids in the military doesn't make any sense. I don't know how my parents did it, but they did. But I was a Questbridge scholar, which they work with Ivy League schools, like prestigious schools and universities, to get students in who are considered low income, like making less than $40,000 average, or, you know, some price per member in the household. And I definitely applied or qualified. And I was in the situation where I was applying for Questbridge, a million other things. I got into the Questbridge program, but they emailed me and I had 24 hours to accept it. And, you know, I guess like a 16-year-old, 17-year-old isn't checking their email on the daily. It completely went by me. And a week later, I see that I was a Questbridge scholar and completely missed this opportunity. And I was devastated to the point where I emailed every single school on that list. It was like 32 schools. And I was like, hey, look, I was supposed to be in your school. I missed this Questbridge opportunity, but I would love to still be there. And everyone denied me. Everybody was like, you just got to do regular decision. We can't help you. So I ended up, again, applying to 32 schools, begging to give me a chance. And I didn't have the best GPA. Again, I was bad at school. And I got accepted into 2 schools, UGA, which wasn't on the Questbridge list, and USC. And I wanted to go to USC. I was like, this is amazing. And they're actually giving me a chance. And it wasn't until I got into USC that I realized I had to pay tuition because I wasn't a Questbridge scholar. And USC currently quotes a bill of about $70,000 a year. That was money I did not have. And after scholarships and financial aid and FAFSA, I was about $10,000 short. And they don't tell you this when you're applying to schools, but when you're short on your tuition, they start locking you out of applying for your classes. So I couldn't actually sign up for any classes until I paid this $10,000 debt, which I couldn't pay, and school was starting in like a month. And this is a really pivotal moment for me because this ends up launching the company. Was I didn't know what to do. And I started applying to loans, you know, the Discover Student Loan Program, private loans. This is like the beginning of, I forget what it's called, income share agreements, ISAs. I'm having my parents apply for stuff and we were getting no luck. A low income family with 9 kids doesn't add up. And I had no credit, no financial backing, anything to qualify myself. And I called the university every day until somehow someone helped me pay my tuition. I don't know what happened to this day, but I was able to walk on campus, not because I was financially able to, but because someone gave me a hand out of nowhere. It taught me that there are millions of people who are gifted, talented, could change the world, that are limited by human-made barriers like financial challenges. And it just felt unacceptable to me. So rather than going to class again, because I wasn't good at it anyways, I was fixated on solving this issue. And ironically, since I applied to classes so late, one of the classes I ended up signing up for, because it was the last thing available, was a freshman seminar called Intro to Entrepreneurship. You can kind of see how fate unplays itself here, or unveils itself here. Is I end up tackling this issue of financial access while I'm in this freshman seminar, which leads to the building, the early stages of what Ultra is today.
Again, so many things to unpack. And what a great story that plays out, to your point, every single year, right? And, you know, it's interesting because as much as I'm a U.S. citizen, although I was born in France, Europe, I became an entrepreneur here. In many levels, I've benefited from a system that allows people who are motivated, qualified, educated to thrive in ways that they can't necessarily in other parts of the world. That being said, the parts of the world that I come from, this whole notion that you wouldn't have access to education or healthcare, by the way, we're not even talking about that, the barriers that exist that get in the way for what are really basic societal goods, right? Because you'd want to actually be able to, on some level, level the playing field, right? Because when you think about it, yes, on the one hand, only the lucky few and the people who have this determination and luck, you know, pierce through. But you're missing out, probably to your point earlier, on so many kids, right? And think about it, right? Like, for some people, $10,000 is literally like just a night out. For other people, it's inaccessible, right? And it sounds like at that stage in your life, it was inaccessible. Did you ever find out who helped you out, or like did someone just write a check, or?
I'm still trying to figure that out to this day. I have no idea.
And someone just called you up and said, the money came in, you're in.
Yeah, like after, I used to call the financial aid office every day. And then one of the days they were like, you're good. You can sign up for classes. And I signed up right away. No questions asked. So it's a crazy story. It really highlights what you're saying about opportunity, because there is only a lucky few. And I got to be one of those lucky few. And Altro is fixated on solving that. Everyone should have opportunity. And healthcare, I don't even want to get into that. It's a, again, same issue. It's just insane.
So we have the makings here of like a determination, a motivation. There's something there. And it's one thing to identify in a very like McKinsey way, like we're going to do some market research. We're going to study a field and a subject matter and come up with like personas and pain points. In this case, the pain point is you. You're experiencing what you think is something that's inherently flawed. So talk to us about, there are several things that are important right at inception. One is, I want to know if you had co-founders and if you had a team that came together. I personally have some views on solo versus team entrepreneurship that I like to talk about. Love to hear your thoughts on that and how that happened, but also how you assessed that this was the right group to come together, if it did, right? And then just, you know, if we go back to the rather structured and a little rigid purpose, problem, solution, market size. And then also like understanding how big you thought the opportunities that was that it was worth going after.
Yeah. And I can answer those in order too, because it kind of follows the story. I ended up meeting my co-founder in college. We had joined this entrepreneurship like society called SCP, Sigma Eta Pi, which sounds like a frat, but really we're just trying to launch startups. And I was about a year into figuring out what Altro was. And we ended up getting paired together as partners. And our goal was to launch a startup. And at this point, I had already done early market adoption. I had like a website, you know, 22 pivots later, trying to figure out what Altro would be. And my co-founder, his background's funny too. He actually launched a company when he was 16, which was a drone delivery company. He had built a drone that using the flashlight on the back of your phone can bring any delivery to you from the drone if it's within 500 meters, which is super cool. But it got shut down by the Trump administration, line of sight provisions. You can't fly a drone when you can't see it, which shut down the company. And unfortunately, he had to go to school. So he's kind of on the flip side. You know, he had the privilege of, you know, building a startup, exploring life, had to go to school because he had to, but he didn't want to. But we both had the same idea of we're bad at school and we want to change the world. And he really resonated with the mission that I wanted to solve. And the mission, despite the 22 pivots, stayed the same. It was people should have equitable access to credit and financial opportunity. And that still is our mission today. And we ended up pulling together a bunch of college students. COVID happened and we moved into a house together to solve this issue. And it actually turned into a fundable company $22 million later. But to address the market size, right? I didn't know what I was getting into. It was a personal issue. And I guess you could call it selfish because I was trying to solve it for myself. But I realized millions of students and young adults face the same reality. And we're learning even now a bigger part of this market is actually millennials. It's funny. Everybody has a story about credit where they were either denied credit, couldn't get into a new apartment, couldn't get the car that they wanted. Everyone has like a wall that they hit when they learn either credit's important or they need to increase their credit score. And that wall shouldn't exist, right? Like everyone should start with good credit and bad actors go down, good actors go up, but everyone shouldn't start at zero. And there's 68 million people a year who face that reality of not being able to prosper, have financial inclusion, or even elevate their personal standing because they don't have access to credit. So it turned out to be like a multi-billion dollar issue. The government is very involved in solving this issue too. You have Operation Reach, which is a government initiative to solve the credit and financial gap. We saw during COVID that the credit gap and financial gap got almost double in size, which is insane to say. And it's made Altro's reality even bigger that this is more than just an idea by a bunch of college students who don't want to go to school. It's actually something that we need to solve for ourselves and for the millions of people who are facing it too.
When I think about, on some level, like the maturity, the foresight that you probably manifested at the time, it's just very, very impressive. So do you think you talk about what you just went through because you've like polished it over time? Like, was it as crystal clear at the time, or it took a while to like formulate exactly what you wanted to do? I mean, it could be that it was just like clear then, clear now, or is it something that just became clear over time?
You know, what's funny is I'll finish the story now. So I bet I use a bunch of college students. We're trying to figure out what this is. We're still in school and we were doing a bunch of pitch competitions. It was not resonating. I did over 100 pitch competitions, dead last every single time. Until one time, I just got up there and told my story. I was like, look, I don't have a deck. I'm just going to tell you what I went through and what I want to solve. And it was our first time getting first place. And it made me realize that, and this goes back to what we said all the way at the beginning of the call about trust and building rapport. Business is nothing but storytelling. And the moment someone can understand the problem that you're solving, can resonate with the problem and sees you as a solution, you've won. That's all business is. And that's what our deck became. I would spend 90% of our deck on the first two slides, which is me introducing myself, explaining how big of a problem it is. Over the last 2 minutes of the pitch, I'll tell them how we're going to solve it. And people didn't care about the solution. They cared about the problem and knowing that we were dedicated to the mission. And that's actually how we got our first investment, was we won this pitch competition for the Blackstone Launchpad in New York called Propel. And a bunch of really great people were there. They bounced up the check from 15K to 25K. It was the most money I had ever seen in my life. And we ended up meeting someone from the Marcy Venture Partners, who's Jay-Z, Jay Brown, and Larry Marcus's fund. Actually, Larry Marcus's daughter at the pitch competition. She was like, you have to meet my dad. So it went from us just winning pitch competitions back to back to me being in front of a fund, which I, again, knew nothing about. All I knew was like Shark Tank. And they're asking me, you know, what is the business? What are you trying to do? How much money are you looking to raise? And I just thought of the biggest number I could imagine in my head at that time. I was like, $250,000 will solve all of our issues. And they wrote the check the next day. And it was just like a crazy moment for me. Because first off, like, I didn't even have a business bank account. Like, again, we were college students. And I don't know if this answers your question. I think the mission was clear. What we wanted to do was clear. But us being mature business owners and operators was a cost that we had to learn over time. And this goes into the future story, which we may not have time for, but we've gone viral twice. We've had over 300,000 people try to download our platform. And we've had to learn, you know, the hard way that excitement and having the dream is great, but execution and being a business manager is something that you probably should go to school for. So it's been a long time coming, but I wouldn't say the story has been perfect since day one. Not at all.
Well, that's an admission of being complete and just honest with your audience and yourself and recognizing. But I could tell you the way it came across and you explained it now is very clear. Back to storytelling, you know, there's one thing. I mean, when you're pitching, you know, folks go out and they never walk into a meeting with materials like collateral, right? It's like, that's not going to win you a deal. You want people to come out of a meeting where they've had a good conversation, they've heard you tell your story, right? Think about when you meet someone at an event, meet someone at a restaurant, a bar, you hear their story. They're not walking into a bar. Like when you're trying to meet someone, you don't go into a bar with a PowerPoint deck that describes how great of a date you're going to be, right? It's like you make a case for yourself, and there's a variety of ways you do this. And then if people are interested, they follow up, or like you follow up and said, you know, you could tell you had a good conversation, you follow up. So I'm not surprised at all that money was raised on a story because it was heartfelt. And at the end of the day, we go back to social capital. We go back to trust. In essence, what you do in that process is you build trust. Suddenly someone listens to you and they're like, yep, I trust this person. They seem genuine. It's a genuine problem that they're going through. And I think based on their experience, I trust them to execute on this. In other words, I'm going to write that check. By the way, again, back to this notion of trust and social capital, I would say, and there's probably studies that have been made, and I'm definitely by no means an expert, but I think most people with high levels of social capital, like take celebrities, for example, are perceived as being more trustworthy, right? It's like people would trust them more. And that's why you parlay that into like brand equity. Like if George Clooney wants to start a spirits company and sell liquor, there's already a ton of brand value and brand equity tied to it. And people trust that him putting his name on the product means it's going to be a good product, right? So understanding that, whether subconsciously or consciously, is a very important part of ultimately building goodwill, right? Because most businesses these days are all about intangible, right? Intangible value creation on the balance sheet. So you got your first check. That sounds at the time like a lot of money, but as you know, right, it's not. And you've since gone out and raised a lot more money, you know, 100 times that in total, if I remember thereabouts, right? Over $20 million. So talk to us about the evolution of how you went out and resourced the business, right? Did you ever think about bootstrapping, or was it always something that you're going to have to raise a lot of money for?
Yeah, I think this part of the story is where we hit the rat race, right? I never thought that we would raise $250,000. And it's crazy to think that we have raised 100x that today. But yeah, we just had to learn. We were very fortunate to become a part of the YC cohort right after we raised. I became a TIL fellow, which put me in a community of amazing founders who were always a step ahead of me and I could learn from. But more than anything, I think that we just had to really end up ironically educating ourselves. And when I go back to what I talked about at the beginning of the call, our conversation about learning how to learn, I think the fortune of me skipping class and teaching myself how to educate myself really played into me becoming an effective CEO. Because I had to learn what people try to do for 30 plus years in the corporate ladder in the matter of 6 months. And building a fintech is not easy. It's probably one of the most regulated, complicated spaces that we have outside of like space tech or med tech. So it just put me in this weird situation where we just had to learn really fast. And we've hired so many people. We've let go of so many people. The business has changed, I want to say every quarter at this point, but the mission has always been the same. And I think that this is a living story. Like it doesn't have an end to it. I'm still learning today. We're very fortunate to have amazing investors, amazing team that teaches me daily how to become a better CEO. And we still have a mission to solve. And, you know, we're very fortunate about how this year has turned out for us. It's looking like we're going to be able to help a lot of people. And it's just been a learning story for the last, call it 4 years now. So time really does fly. So yeah, it's from 18 to 24, it's been a journey, but really, really grateful about the learnings I've had across the way.
It's also a period of in one's life, right? I mean, to think about it, that your cerebral cortex is not fully formed. Literally, you're still evolving so much as, you know, biologically, like as a human, but at the same time, you're really at a point in your life where you're able to learn and adapt very, very, very quickly. Talk to us a little bit about some key mentors and advisors along the way that have been instrumental, right? And I always say, especially if you start really early, that you're going to need that to make up for the fact that, quite frankly, you haven't spent 10 years at a company building relationships, building a track record.
No, very true. I do have to, there's so many hats that I have to give and flowers I got to give to people who have been instrumental in my life. From Sebastian DeViva, who helped me figure out what a pitch deck is, to our current investors and Marcy Venture Partners. But I would say currently who's been the most influential is definitely Rich Sinha from Pendulum, who currently sits on our board, and Joanna Reese, who sits on the board of FICO, who also sits on our board. And I bother them all the time, whether it's 2 a.m., 7 a.m., 3 in the afternoon, asking them questions about how do I make decisions? How do I become a better leader? What do we need to focus on as a company? And as we've gone through one of the craziest droughts in fintech history, in VC capital history, and just startups in general, they have been a really strong guiding star in making sure I and the company do what we need to do. So I think mentors are key. I think mentors should change over time based off of what you're trying to solve. I think early on, it was understanding just how to grow up. Now it's how do you be an effective leader and manager? But it really is instrumental. I would say it's paramount for me to have great mentors by my side, and I wouldn't be here without them. So,
yeah, and for thought and learnings for listeners, again, part of what I'm trying to do also is give some perspective and share, allow founders to share their journey and, you know, provide guidance in along the way as to how they're going about it. You say it wasn't always perfect. You made some mistakes, as I'm sure you did. Talk to us a little bit about human capital, like how you thought about scaling. I'll be honest, it's very hard to do if you don't have a little bit of background, and it's very hard to do if you don't necessarily have the experience. But look, there are people with 20 years of experience who do it really poorly. It's really foundational. Think about it as laying the building blocks for any business that's so reliant and dependent on human capital. It's the bulk of how assets and value are created. Talk to us about how it was and how you scaled and what were the mistakes you made along the way.
Yeah, this is a great question. Human capital is just such a important and pivotal part of a business. When you think about the culture that is going to develop, the difference that having a great employee from a good employee makes, and how fast a company moves just matters about the chemistry that you have with your team. And it took me a while to understand this. I think we had the privilege of being like a celebrity brand. So we have, you know, a number of celebrities on our cap table, amazing investors, you know, huge firms invested in Ultra, which has made it a hot commodity to work at, which I think is a privilege for us. And it really helped us, you know, cover the trough of having 19-year-old founders, right? It felt a little bit like Stripe. And I would say that this was a blessing and a curse because we grew way too fast. Right after our Series A, before I even hit TechCrunch, we had grown maybe 4 or 5x to like 60, 70 employees. And it was detrimental to the company. It got us to a point where we were burning insane amounts of money, more money than I could ever imagine. There was, you know, cultural chaos. You know, interperson fighting was bigger of an issue than it was to solve the actual mission that we were trying to solve. And this was definitely a learning for me, was having the right people at the table really makes a difference on how fast you move. And we've downsized and corrected our team size, especially with how markets have been. And we have been moving faster now than we ever have before as a company, due to having the right human capital at the table. So I do think that, in short, hiring is never going to be done right on its first try, second, even its third. But when you do find superstars, hold on to them, build your culture off of them, and make sure that you're not only finding cultural fits, but you're getting cultural adds. That's something Erica on our team says a lot, because you don't want to develop a culture that stays the same. You want a culture that grows and changes and adds on top of it as positive inputs. And I don't think a lot of people think that way when they think about culture and teams.
So there's many, many things to, again, unpack here and discuss. One of them being process, right? So as much as there's a qualitative aspect to assessing on the human resources side, you have to go about it in a way that's highly systematic. And where I see time and again such efforts failing, it's because it's always the same thing, is where people fail is because they don't have the discipline to stick to the process. Like, it's not that they can't sit down and come up with the process. It's they, things happen. It's just like working out, right? It's like, you know, it's good for you. But then when it's like 5:30 a.m., the alarm rings, it's like, you know, maybe I'm going to snooze it. Maybe I'm not going to go work out. I'm tired, this and that, right? Same thing with hiring. It's like, oh, we're busy. We're running around. I'm running a company. But there is a process, right? It's like you have to go and follow the steps that you've defined. And there are ways. Not everyone has to go about it in the exact same manner, but there are time-tested methods by which you can assess, right? People skip on those. They skip on the assignments, skip on the tests. They skip on the qualitative interviews. In the last few years, people were being hired over a video call. And now that we're thankfully off of the pandemic era, and hopefully we don't have to come back to that madness, in that we can meet people, there's the convenience of being able to interview and tap into a broader pool of talent. But I'd say even if someone's on the other coast, like, you need to go fly out and meet that person, because there are things that you will see, notice, learn from that interaction that you wouldn't otherwise be able to assess. And that's process at the end of the day, right? So if someone doesn't do this in their process and skips it, it's not that they don't know that it's a good step. It's just that for whatever reason, they've decided they're going to skip it. And time and again, and I speak also with a former like systematic trading background, it's like time and again, when you skip the rules, you will make mistakes. The other thing that's very important, and I actually wanted to know, because we haven't talked about it, right? And culture eats strategy for breakfast, right? Culture is so important. So you have this like genuine philosophy and pain point that you've identified. And even from this conversation, you come across as having this like very highly contagious, like positive attitude and personality. How did you think about crafting the culture within the group? And how did you think about preserving that as you were making your own management mistakes, right? And hiring and firing people, like how do you preserve that culture?
Yeah. And I wish we had a better word for culture, because I feel like it's overused. But culture really is everything. It really does eat strategy for breakfast. And we got to a point where our culture was a mess. We had no control over it. And I think that you get to this point where you realize that it doesn't matter how skilled or how amazing someone's resume is. If you cannot get along with that person, or if you can't go to dinner with that person and talk for more than 30 minutes, you're not going to work well together. It's very funny. We, in the YC world, they talk about co-founders and your starting team is almost like a marriage. And it is. It's like a family. It's like, if you can't see this person every day without getting mad, it's not going to work. And that works on a bigger scale as well. And I'm not saying that you need to be able to hang out with every one of your employees every day, but there has to be some sort of vibe or chemistry that your team holds that starts at the core. And it starts at the founders themselves. The founders have to embrace and be the culture that they want to see. And as you probably tell from the hour we've spent together so far, I'm a very vulnerable person. I talk about anything and everything under the sun, and I don't hide anything. And I've embraced that culture through the company to a point where we are very vulnerable with each other. We talk about our wins. We talk about our losses. We talk about how we're feeling. And it's embraced the culture of high performance, ironically, right? And when you look at cultures like Amazon or Apple, where everything's like go, 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 you end up having high churn. You end up having an unproductive workforce, people who are tired, burnt out. And we were at that stage for a moment, but now we're moving faster than ever. Ironically, not talking about being high performance. So I wish it was a better word for this. I really focus on culture. 90% of my day is how am I showing up and how is the team showing up and are we on the same wavelength? Because without it, you really don't have a strategy. You don't have a team. You can't perform.
Having gone through the last few years, right? If you think about where you're at right now about the business, talk to us about if you're describing in terms of like the actual unit economics, right? What makes the business? Who are the target customers? What are the dependencies and counterparties? Who is your main competition? How do you go about capturing market share and generating sustainable engagement? You know, I'd love to hear now as a much more mature leader of your business compared to that initial idea, if you could articulate that for us and help people understand exactly how it works.
Yeah, of course. And just for people who may not know Ultra, we're a credit builder. We help people build credit using their subscriptions. So your Netflix, Hulu, Spotify. We're formerly known as Perch Credit, is the name that we went viral under. And we've had an interesting year. We started out as a free product. Like I said, we were number 3 in the App Store, 300,000 plus downloads. We are a hacker house of like 9 people trying to figure it out. And we learned very quickly that there's a need for people to have access to accessible credit, credit that doesn't have a high APR, any APR in our case, that anyone can use as long as they have a Netflix account and they're paying that off each month. And it helps people get started in the system. And we've had the privilege of actually launching the product this year on a national rollout is actually what we're focused on, which you'll hear about 30 days, which is super exciting from the date that we're recording this. But we were only available in 9 states prior. And when I talk about market share, opportunity, and where we were, there's a number of people who have jumped into this game because the market is huge. There's 68 million people who can't get access to credit each year. And there's hundreds of millions of people who need access to credit and credit products just in the U.S. alone. So it's an ever-growing situation. You know, there's 21 million college students each year. 50% of them walk into their first class without a credit score. So we're really trying to solve this issue of redefining what credit is. And the market's huge. And I think the economics play out well against that as well, because it's not just about helping them build their credit. It's about building that full profile, right? And when you think about credit unions, banks, financial institutions, where they find their opportunity is being that story, that moment for people each time in their life, their first car, their first home, their first, second, third credit card. And we want to be an accessible route to having a safe journey on that path. So that's the future for us. That's where we want to be, is no matter where you are in your financial journey, whether you're trying to get an Amex Black card or if you're just trying to get a credit card, we want to be able to help people get there. And I think Credit Karma is such a great signal to what Altrio can be, because all they do is just guide people to the right place. And they've built a multi-billion dollar brand off of that. So that's kind of the space that we operate in today.
So versus, let's say, a seasoned operator, person who's been running, operating a business of that nature, take, for example, senior executives at Credit Karma, what did it take for you to start? And where do you think you are in that journey to master, again, the technicals when it comes to the financial aspects of the business and really getting a good handle on, like, what are your levers in terms of operating the business? And is it something that you have to rely heavily on a team that you've assembled, or is it something that, you know, you have a desire in mastering and having a lot of control over?
Yeah, no, I would not be here if it wasn't for people who knew more than me stepping up to the plate. So I had the fortune of being the youngest ever, or maybe not ever, but a very young board member of a financial institution when I was in university, actually. I got to be on the board of the USC Credit Union, which I'm still on the board of today, which has taught me so much about finance that I did not know. It still did not prepare me for launching a fintech product. There's so many regulations, so many processes with the bureaus and with your issuer and bank and networks that there's just no way you'll know without stubbing your foot. And that's what we went through, was we were super viral, but we didn't have the product. We had no idea how we could actually bring this product to life on a scalable manner. And that's what we've gone through as a company. It's like YC normally tells you to build in 2 weeks when we had to build in 2 years. And going back and reflecting, if I had to do this again, I could probably do it in 6 to 12 months. But we had to take that time to A, learn and educate ourselves on how the space works and why it's so unfair for people, and B, apply that into actually building a product that is somewhat novel to current market standards. And we had to hire a lot of great people to do that: legal counsel, operators, financial experts, you know, everything under the sun to get to where we are today. And I'm very glad with where we got in, because we do have a national rollout coming out. It's with a huge, you know, corporate partner network, and it's going to be something that's novel to market. But we didn't get here overnight. We started in 9 states. We moved up to 11 states. Our partners shut down. Like, it's been a story. It's been a startup story for sure. But now we're coming back, I think, better than ever this year. And it's taken a long time, a lot of education to get there.
So right now, big word on the street is it used to be growth at all costs. And in some models, I mean, you know, again, if you want to be on that trajectory, there's a tremendous amount of pressure from venture firms, because that is the model to capture the power law effect in their portfolio, to really push for aggressive acquisition of beachheads of customers and demonstrate that you can hit a very, very steep growth curve. There is, I think, a growing trend right now to manage to margins and optimally find that trade-off between growth and profitability. By the way, as someone who's seen a number of cycles, because it dates me, I've been around for a while, you know, these things ebb and flow, right? And every boom, you see the rules go out the window and suddenly they come back with a vengeance. How do you guys think about that trade-off right now? What's the mindset? You're obviously someone who thinks a lot about go-to-market and acquisition of customers. You've talked about scale. You've talked about the potential for this. How disciplined do you want to stay, and making sure that, you know, not only the opportunity is significant, but you'll have the wherewithal to make it through.
Yeah. And this being my first cycle, I need to get advice from you, but I completely agree that growth at all costs was a phase. And there's a lot of data that supports it, right? Like, it doesn't make sense in the world of just normal capitalism theory for non-profitable companies to IPO, which is what we had, right? We had companies with negative business models that just had millions of users, you know, hitting market, and not a single one of them stand to their IPO price today. And it's funny, there was a publish on LinkedIn about fintechs. There's only been two fintechs in like the last 15 years who have IPO'd profitably. One of them is Bill.com, and I can't remember the second one. But growth at all costs is just not a model. And I think we're realizing that at Altro. Like, we raise our Series A off of hype, but our Series B is really just about execution.
Series B is usually when the rubber really meets the road, because especially in a venture progression, right? I mean, if you think about the template for success is growing at an incredibly high clip, right? 70, 100% a year the first few years, and nowhere at any point in time should it be below that 50% annualized growth. And when it gets there, people start getting a little nervous, which is actually just unbelievable, right? Because a business that's growing 50% a year is a phenomenal business, but it's just not enough to be able to generate the kind of return that will get investors to pay up and justify the progression that is needed to return money to investors. So the Series B usually is a promise. It's less of a reality. It's really a promise that you're going to be able to realize on your goals. And to your point, exactly, it's execution. And whatever it takes to grow up to $10 million is very different than going from 10 to 30, 50. And that's a progression that becomes a challenge for many businesses and for many teams. And it's also very different in a B2B context than it is in the direct to consumer. So there's all kinds of nuances. And at the end of the day, no one's going to be able to have the same passion and drive and purpose that drove you to start this business. But the beauty of it is one's ability to convince others to give them their resource on the basis of a vision that affords you the opportunity to find really good talent, right? And if you create the right culture, and if you're disciplined about saving those resources and preserving it to continue to attract the best talent, there are folks out there who are really good at helping execute, right? And I think it's essential to, again, back to the human capital, back to structuring it in the right way, aligning the incentives, bringing the right people on board. And it takes a different set of people to go from 0 to 10 to 10, 30, 50 again. What are you, if you think about fintech broadly and the space you're in, but even if we took like even a broader perspective, we're definitely at a juncture, at a transition, at a macro level, geopolitical level. It's a complicated, highly complex, multifaceted world out there. There's social implications, there's economic implications. How do you think about the world? What are you excited about in the realm of how fintech can deliver better value to people and companies?
It is so exciting. I got to set up the framework for it first. Is the best companies are the ones that innovate an archaic system, right? And is able to capture market share off of a faster, better, more accessible product. That's what capitalism curates. The issue with fintech is that it's so archaic and so regulated that it's almost impossible for anyone to play ball in this space. And I think that is starting to change. It takes years for a fintech to get live in this space, and it costs a lot of money to get there. But I think that over time, we're going to see a breakthrough in accessibility to create and be creative in the fintech space. And that's going to lead to a personalization of finance that we haven't seen before, to the point where we could treat fintech and financial services as SaaS tools in your life. So whether you are a middle-class worker who's working 9 to 5, who loves video games and playing pickleball on the weekends, to someone who is very affluent, looking for financial freedom, trying to buy their second home, you're going to have a financial experience tailored specifically to you that revolves around your habits, your activity, your spending power, and what's important to you. And I think that that revolution is going to come very quickly within the next 10 to 20 years. That is really going to redefine what it means to be financially savvy or financially accessible. And I think it's going to open up a whole new world where everyone doesn't need to be on a Chase Sapphire. Everyone doesn't need an Amex Platinum. You can have a card or program or system dedicated to your lifestyle, which is super unique. And I think we saw that a little bit with the world of neobanks, right? Like we saw neobanks focus on Black communities. We saw neobanks focus on LGBTQ plus communities. And that was a very interesting wave that I think has dissipated over time. But I think it's going to come back and it's going to be very unique. And whoever's able to capture that and be a community-driven financial services product will really redefine, you know, what it means to be financially savvy.
That's awesome. What a great way to close on this conversation. I've really enjoyed it. I think listeners will draw a ton of conclusions and insights from your journey, which is really at its beginning, right? And kudos to you for having taken a step. It takes a lot of courage, probably something you honed in over the years and trying to overcome some of the challenges that were set in your path. So really kudos to you for achieving what you have up until now. And I'm really looking forward to seeing how things progress over the next couple of years. But yeah, it's been a pleasure having you on the podcast and I'm looking forward to staying in touch.
For sure. Thank you so much and have a great rest of your day.
This podcast is produced by Rado Venture Management LLC, RVM. RVM is not an investment advisor. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent, not investment advice.